So hello, everyone, and welcome to this audio conference training for Rural Grantees of the Office on Violence Against Women. Our topic today is working to end teen dating violence in rural areas. We scheduled this special topic in recognition of Teen Dating Violence Awareness Month, and so we're delighted that you all could join us. We've had a huge response to this call, and so I think we're going to have really a lot of people on the call, and therefore there should be a lot of interesting questions and comments. I'm excited about that. I'm Liz Carlson, and I'll be the host for our topic today. I'm joined on the line by our guest speaker, Melissa Skaya, who is a Praxis Technical Assistance Partner and is the Executive Director of Advocates for Family Peace, which is an advocacy program and shelter in Grand Rapids, Minnesota. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Hi, welcome. I'm not going to take any time away from our topic today by formally introducing Melissa, because I believe you should have all received her bio. But I would ask Melissa if you would be willing to get us rolling today by just starting to talk about what your specific experience is around teen dating violence, and then from there we'll just kind of segue into your PowerPoint.
Okay, great. So welcome, everyone. I'm glad that there's so many people on this call. So I'll just start out by telling a little bit of context to how I come to this work, and I'll just start by sharing a personal story. My experience in violence, my personal experience comes from when I was a teenager. I was 16 years old, and I was most 16-year-old girls in terms of, like, I was totally infatuated with boys, and all I thought about was boys, and wanted a boyfriend, and was in this relationship, and was in this relationship for quite a long time, and over time it became very, very controlling. But it ended in a pretty violent episode in which I was physically and sexually assaulted by this boy. And so I only tell you that only just to, you know, I'm not going to go into the details of it, but just to say that this is a topic that has a lot of meaning to me, is really important to me, and it's my life experience that got me into this work altogether. And so I also had a whole experience with my parents finding out, and so I have going to talk a little bit about how to work with parents of teens, which comes from my work experience and my personal experience. It was, I'll tell you, in some ways it was very, very, very difficult when my parents found out, for many reasons. But so when I was going to college, and then I went to graduate school, I was knew that because of my own personal experience, I wanted to go into some sort of social services work or social work or some human service direct client contact work. And I just have to tell you that I, you know, believe, like, in serendipity or karma or whatever word you want to use, or intervention, that the perfect job came open. And it was a job in my home area. I was living in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area at the time and wanted to get back to northern Minnesota. And a position opened at a domestic violence program in northern Minnesota to work with teens and teen dating violence relationships and to be the operations manager of the shelter. So it was kind of a dual role position, and they were looking for someone who then they could train to be the executive director, because she was going to be retiring. And so it was just perfect. And so I applied for that job and got that job. And so I tell you that because my very first work in the domestic violence field or movement was working with teens and children, so children who lived in with homes with a lot of domestic violence. And that's what I ended up doing my master's thesis on, was on domestic violence in children. And then I did a lot of work with teens. In fact, even though I'm the executive director now, you know, we're not that large of a community, not that large as an organization, so other directors of rural programs will know what I'm talking about when I say, you know, I still do direct client work. In fact, I ended up doing direct client work just yesterday with a teenager, and I'll just share some elements of that and, you know, some of the things I even learned then. So just because I'm the director doesn't mean, you know, I'm not in touch with it. We really make it our purpose that all people do direct client work at our organization. And because I had started out doing the presentations at the schools at the time about teen dating violence and developed those, I develop a relationship with the teachers in the schools, I still do some of those. And so I've trained some other youth staff, but I still do enjoy doing them and do that work. So right now I'm the director of Advocates for Family Peace. It's a six program domestic violence agency in north central Minnesota. So I come from a rural area. I grew up in a rural area. I work in a rural area, and I'm a rural girl at heart. I love small towns. I love the atmosphere they bring. And so as Liz said, I also do technical assistance and training with Praxis International, and then I also do work on occasion with the National Network to End Domestic Violence and then the National Council of Juvenile and Family Court Judges. And then we just finished writing a curriculum about addressing fatherhood with men who batter and producing a DVD. So enough about all that. We'll get into talking about this topic. Just know we're going to kind of break this up into about half-hour segments or so to take questions and comments. And so we'll unmute the lines at that time. So just jot down your question. We'll take the time to answer those. But know that I kind of have, you know, this is a really big topic to talk about. And so I'm going to cover this topic, and I'm assuming that you're all going to have the PowerPoint. But, you know, what we're going to be covering is just talking about teen dating violence relationships themselves, the dynamics that are in those. And then we're going to talk a little bit about the advocacy of the direct client advocacy of teens who are in teen dating violence relationships. We're going to talk a little bit about teenagers with their parents. We're going to talk about some of the legal issues with teens, and then we're going to talk at the end segment. We're going to be talking about community presentations about teen dating violence. And so that's kind of how we have it divided up so that you know sort of what's coming up. And so I first just want to talk a little bit about violence in teen relationships and some of the dynamics. And so, you know, you can really take, you know, I know there's some wheels about teen dating violence, and you can take the power and control wheel, and many of the experiences that adults, battered women or victims experience are the same as teens, but they're also different. And so, you know, and that, of course, is because of their age and their experience and the nature of the relationship. And so teen violent relationships, you know, of course, we've heard about the many, many tragedies of teens who were murdered or killed or severely beaten in teen dating violence relationships, and our hearts certainly go out to their family and to those who have survived that. We had a young girl in our own community. Actually, it was six blocks from my house. I remember I was coming home from an event on a Saturday, and I was driving by our local nursing home, and I saw all these police and the ambulance, and I was diverted to coming back home. And I asked my husband, I said, what's going on at the nursing home? He said, I don't know, and we know someone who's on the police commission. So we ended up finding out quite soon after that there was a young girl who was working there. She was 17, and she had gone out to her car during a break, and she had recently broken up with her boyfriend, and she went out to her car to get her school books to study during her break. And as she was about to get out of her car, her boyfriend, who she just broke up with, shot her in the head. And she was able to somehow miraculously put her book up in front of her head the very last second. And so the bullet went through her school book first and then into her head. And he thought, we believe, that she had died. And then he shot himself and killed himself. She miraculously lived. And the reason why she lived was because the doctors tell us that her skull cracked. And so her brain was able to swell. And so had her skull not cracked, her brain would not have been a swell. And so it's just an example of some of the real, real tragedy. And this is a man who, in her description, she's done a lot of talking about this. Now, this happened 3 years ago. She said there were, that he had said some things before, but he had never physically harmed her before. He hadn't even as much grabbed her before. He hadn't hit her before. He had did controlling behaviors towards her, but never hit her. And so, you know, we have to really think about what sort of theories and thinking we have about violent relationships. I'm not one to subscribe to the belief that violence escalates each time with each incident. And I don't subscribe to that theory because it just hasn't been my experience with adults or with teens, with all of them. Now, it certainly happens with some of them, but when I subscribe sort of to a theory about why something happens, I want it to generally be applicable to almost all the situations that come before me. And so I think that, and her first name is Jamie, and when Jamie, you know, was shot, that just was not her experience. And so I do want to just tell you quickly that Jamie now, she's volunteered for the Duluth Domestic Violence program before. She just graduated with her master's in social work. So she's miraculously overcome this leaps and bounds. But I just share that story because we do have to be reminded of the tragic, tragic consequences of this. And I'll tell you the thing about when that happens with a teenager, there's a thing about when this happens with young people that, in my experience, rallies the community more than it does with an adult. And that's something that I think requires some discussion, and we're not going to do that today. But when these sort of things happen, it really became this opening for us as a domestic violence community to talk about violence in all relationships, not just in teens, but in all relationships. And the community surrounded this young girl and her family in a way that was just amazing. And I have to tell you that also her father was is the superintendent of our school. And so, you know, of course, it was an awakening for him in many, many aspects in many ways, but also just about violence and relationships. And I know that throughout the country that some states have started to implement some requirement about in the curriculum. I believe it's Rhode Island, and maybe there's someone on the phone from the Northeast. They can give more details. But I know that there's a few states, and I believe this, Rhode Island is one, where it's required now in the high school curricula about healthy relationships. And so there has been a movement around this issue in coming years about this issue. We also, you know, have to know, though, that this experience of teens, you know, it runs all across the spectrum in terms of the severity of the violence and the frequency. So when we're thinking about violence in any sort of relationship, we always want to be thinking about the context of it. So we want to be thinking about what's the severity, what's the risk, and what's the frequency of it. Those will tell us some things about the context. Because what we do know, of course, that teens experience sexual violence at alarming rates. You know, you can pull out any sort of statistics or data from any state, you know, and find out that, you know, one in five girls will have experienced some sort of sexual assault or sexual violence in their own relationships, and it's even higher in terms of being pressured to do things sexually with their partners that they don't want to do. And so the issue of sexual violence is very, very prominent. There's lots and lots of stories of forced intercourse. And I'm using that term forced intercourse and also I want to use the term rape, but also just to think about that there's this coercion that goes with it. And so, for example, I mean, things like, you know, I will break up with you if you don't, or I will show everyone that picture I took of you if you don't have sex with me. And so the force part of my language is about the coercion that happens. So it's not just the physical or sexual assault part of the relationship that happens, but also there's extraordinary pressure that happens to young girls in particular about this issue. And so most often in teen dating violent relationships, what ends up happening is that the abuser's foremost tactic is isolating her from her friends. And that there's this real, real draw to keep her close, to know where she is at all times. And I'm going to be talking a little bit about technology and abuse in just a couple minutes. But, you know, with the use of cell phones and texting, there's really this need to have control in terms of, I want you with me, I only want you with me, and I want to know what you're doing all the time. And the moment that the young abuser finds out that any of her friends is giving her information about, you know, I don't know, I don't really like him, there's something about him I think you should be worrying about, you know, I found out he said these things about you. The moment that happens is the moment that he draws her closer to him. And there's a lot of manipulation. And we also have to remember that, you know, of course, that we're talking about young people. And so, you know, with many young girls in particular, there's this way about convincing the victim in these young relationships about, you know, I love you. And we have to remember that this is a time where there's just starting to, you know, really explore these ideas, and probably, you know, a lot younger, but in terms of relationships, thinking, you know, what is love? What does it look like? Is this what it is? A lot of them haven't had any experience at all or much previous experience with other relationships, and their models of relationships in terms of healthy are often few and far between. But there's this real draw and need to keep her close. And so I remember recently when I did a high school presentation, and I asked the classroom, I said, and it was a classroom of boys and girls, I said, okay, I want all of you to raise your hand if you know someone in this school and what you would consider that one of the persons in that relationship is just whipped over the other person. Just written, don't use any names. And when I asked that question, 98% of the students raised their hand. And, you know, I've been real fortunate that nobody's used names, but they kind of, you know some of these relationships. And that's the thing about it, is that, you know, there's such a network of talk and gossip and rumors that go within junior high and high school that everybody knows what's happening in these relationships, but nobody's really stepping forward. But they know that these are girls and boys that have been really isolated from their friends. But there's, you know, extraordinary pressure, you know, in teen relationships and with teens. For those of you that have teenagers right now, or maybe not too far, you remember that the world view of many teenagers does not go beyond their group of friends or beyond their school, their high school or their junior high. That whatever happens within that social network and that social group of people is what they look within. And so there's extraordinary pressure to be like others, to fit in. There's extraordinary pressure from girls from a very, very young age to be in relationships and about how to act in relationships. So we have to spend a lot of time thinking about how we're socializing young girls and about how we're socializing young boys, about what relationships look like. But within this community, there's a lot of pressures of how to act and behave. And so I kind of shared the statistic already about, you know, it's about 1 in 5 teenagers have reported that they've experienced physical abuse. We do have to think about what are the differences in teen relationships from adult relationships. So I'm on the second slide now for those of you who are following along. So, you know, of course, the big difference is that these relationships between teens are not, you know, almost rarely legally binding. And legally binding meaning through marriage or children. Now, of course, we know a lot of teens do have kids, but even the legal binding in that sort of relationship is not the same as it is in terms of marriage. So teens, though, in relationships, so the drawback of that is that in terms of those relationships, they often have very little access to money, transportation, or safe places to go. And so what this means is that, you know, in teen relationships, if they don't have access to resources, or they're scared to have access to resources, or if they don't have a vehicle, so if something happens and they want to get away and say, if the boyfriend's, you know, has the access to the car, she's only walking around, you know, a town. And that's the thing about a rural community. You know, I always say that there's kind of this misnomer about, you know, I think there's a lot of stereotype about large cities being so unsafe. And I always say, geez, you know, I think that rural areas are so unsafe in so many ways because there's no anonymity at all. You know, if somebody wanted to know where you were, it really only takes probably about 3 phone calls and they will find out what you've done in the last 24 hours because somebody will have seen you. And that's particularly true with young people and in young relationships, that especially in rural areas, that there's very, very little anonymity about where people are at in rural areas. And so because these relationships, though, aren't legally bound, it does allow, of course, some level of advantage, but the strength that happens within the binding of young love, or what's, you know, being labeled as young love, is in some ways stronger than any of us will ever know, or that maybe we can remember from when we were back in that age. Because the infatuation that happens in terms of young love is very, very strong. And so if any of you can just sort of reflect for a moment to thinking back about, you know, what was infatuation. I mean, I know that there's been some studies that have been done about being infatuated with someone, meaning they're all you think about. You make every move to meet their needs. And many of these are very, very irrational decisions that people make when people become infatuated. I remember talking with a young girl, and she said, my heart, she goes, I don't know if this is love, she said, but my chest actually aches just thinking about him. She goes, he's all I think about all day long, and I just want to make him happy. It's all I want to do. I can just see myself. And that's the other thing about young love and this infatuation is that they just think about them all the time. And young girls in particular, because their way that they're socialized, have this idea that they're going to, you know, marry, have kids, and grow old with the first person that they have a relationship with. So this is not true for every girl, but if you spend some time talking to teenage girls, it's really common. And so particularly in rural areas, if they don't see themselves having a future maybe outside of that community. And so young teenagers also then have a sexual experience, meaning having sexual intercourse in this teen relationship, what happens then in terms of their thinking is that many of them believe, you know, this is my first. I gave my person to this one. I'll never leave them. And so this idea that they want to change their partner if they have been abusive is really, really high. And so, or they think they're thinking about sort of about denial. Denial is very, very strong. And so I've talked to many, many young girls who say, oh, he'll never do that again. It was a once occurrence. And that may be true, but we also know the danger. I mean, our experience tells us what the danger of that relationship is in terms of, you know, just her own freedom within being in a relationship, her own emotional health, her own physical health. And so we have to really think about these relationships, about what binds teens together in relationships, because so often my experience is that teen dating relationships, in terms of the victim wanting to end the relationship, is often pretty low in terms of saying that, you know, I know that he won't do it again. He promises me he won't, but he's my first. He'll never do it again. And then the things that young men will tell young girls in terms of that they're so extraordinarily sorry, and many of them are, for what they have done. And that's why when we look at these relationships, we have to be thinking about the frequency and severity of the violence, because we have to be giving young victims in teen dating relationships the information that they need, But we also have to remember that we have to do it in a way, in a language that they'll understand and they'll know. And so I always say, for those of you, now this is kind of my generation, but, you know, we don't want to be the Charlie Brown teacher, right? I mean, to young kids and young teenagers in terms of, and what all they hear from us is wah, 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 right? That nothing that we hear is something that will stick with them and will make an impact. And the other big difference in teen dating relationships is that teens, in terms of their disclosing, most teens, when you ask them why they didn't talk about or tell someone about what was happening, it was because they didn't want their parents to know. It was a really strong factor. And so we're going to talk about confidentiality in just a few minutes, but not, they really want to keep it from their parents. Now, most parents have some indication that something's going on, but the level and extent, most parents don't. They're really concerned about confidentiality, about where it's going to go in terms of who they tell. A lot of teens are really concerned about getting child protection or some sort of social agency involved in the relationship, and they don't know what their legal rights are in terms of the relationships. And so for the teens who do want to end their relationship, they don't know if they can get like a restraining order or if they have a right to, you know, to tell the police what's happened and what's going to happen with that. And so teens are keeping a lot to themselves for some real valid reasons, or they're seeking information from their teenage friends. And, you know, sometimes that's really good information and sometimes it's really poor information. And so we have to really be hearing from the teens. And so it's about 2:30, so I'm going to stop right now and see if there's any questions or comments. And I do want to say that I want this to be, I want to hear from experiences that other people are having. I want to hear about, you know, questions that you have and about what some of the dynamics that you've heard of or seen in your own community. Particularly, of course, because this is a rural grant, we want to focus on rural communities.
Very good. So at this time, if you have a question or a comment to share with the group, you can press the number 1 on your telephone, and that will put you into the operator question queue, and we'll be able to take your questions individually. So at this time, for questions and comments, press the number 1.
So far, we have no questions in the queue. We do have one question now. It comes from Working to End Teen Dating Violence. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Mary from Pave in Bennington, Vermont.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to clarify what age group we're talking about when we talk about teens.
Yeah, no, good. I'm glad that you said that. I generally am saying that I'm talking about, I'm including what I sort of call tweens in this group, and so I'm talking anywhere from, you know, say 11, 12 to 18.
Okay.
Yep. Do you want to say a little bit about your experience in your community?
Basically, we're trying to put together some programs in the middle school. That's where I guess girls seem to get infatuated.
Yes.
That. So they're starting younger and younger. So we're trying to do that, put together some, you know, education into the, you know, going into middle schools.
Yeah, and have you tried that? I mean, have you done some things, I assume, already? And
yeah, we've had a group that we got together and put together a curriculum. It's called Safety. I don't know if you're aware of that, but
no.
It was a very small group. So, like I said, it's been very difficult to try to implement programs here in the school systems, but we're working at it.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We also have a question from Working to End Dating Violence in Rural Communities. Your line is open.
Go ahead.
Hi, this is Darlene. I work with Alternative Horizons in Durango, Colorado.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, I don't know if you're going to talk about it later on in your presentation, about I think it would be great to hear about what other people do in their rural communities, because I kind of find that some of the like the national curriculums or the higher evidence-based curriculums aren't always appealing to teens,
mm-hmm.
and that finding creative ways to reach our teens in our schools and presenting creative ways to our schools
mm-hmm.
has been more beneficial for us as a in rural area. So
are you talking about in terms of reaching out to them to have them come to some event or some group, or just presenting them sort of as a presentation or community education?
Both would be lovely.
Yeah, no, we're gonna do community education the last segment.
Okay.
Yeah, we're gonna
okay.
spend quite a bit of time on that. Yeah.
Great. Thank
Great.
You.
Yeah, thank you.
Our next question comes from El Refugio. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Colleen from El Refugio in Silver City, New Mexico.
Yes.
And we're a very rural area. We have extremely high rates of teen dating violence. And we're starting a program here that involves peer educators and those peer educators going out into the community to talk to their peers about said issues around teen dating violence. And my question is, and this is something that I've been very curious about, one of the reasons, like you were just saying, that teens don't come forward to talk to anybody about the abuse is the fear of the legal system and, of course, Child Protective Services.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the instances where these peer educators are going out into the community to talk to other teens, and this program has not officially started yet, we're still in the recruitment process, but I am going to imagine, obviously, that some of these peers are going to disclose at some point to these peer educators.
Yep.
And I wanted to kind of know if you had experience with that, how you handle it,
mm-hmm.
'cause obviously they're developing a trusting relationship with somebody that, you know, a teen that is educated on these issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is a bit tricky in terms of if the let me just start out by saying this. I'm not an attorney, and I don't provide an official opinion. I'm just going to give my experience, okay?
So okay.
There's my lawyerly talk.
Okay.
I'm not a lawyer, right? My lawyer friends tell me to say that stuff. So here's my experience, is that if the peer educators are acting as an agent of your organization, meaning that you've trained them, you've organized them, and that you're sending them out on your organization's behalf, you're going to run into some issues if one of those teens that they're getting help from is harmed and nobody says anything. You know, so I'm just going to, like, of course, the worst case scenario is that you have a peer educator who's out, and I assume that these are teen peers. When we're talking peers, we're talking other teens. Is that
yeah.
what you're doing? Okay. So if you have, teen, Jane, who's your peer educator, and she's going out and she's connected with Sally, who's the victim, right? And Sally's disclosed to Jane some things that are a very, very concern, and something tragic happens to Sally, the victim, and that you has knowledge about it, and she was under a certain age, depending on what your state says about mandated reporting, there's some real potential. Now, I don't usually give worst-case scenario, but I'm just giving it as just like an example, because anytime you send someone out as an agent of your organization, you have some responsibility in that way, in terms of how, in terms of, being a mandated reporter, in terms of confidentiality, and in terms of informing the peer, informing the supervisor of the peer educators about what's going on.
Okay, thank you.
So yeah, it's not easy, and it's not a legal opinion, but it's just I would just ask all those questions in your community.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but that's a great model and way to do it. But we just have to, be clear in terms of our guidelines about, what this means.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah.
So, Melissa, I have a little bit of a follow-up question to that.
Mm-hmm.
So what are other options that programs have in order to not create that, Charlie Brown kind of approach to connecting
right.
with teens?
Right.
Do you have other ideas, suggestions?
Yeah, I mean, the peer educator one is a good one. I just think we have to be that when you train the peer educators, they have to know what they, they kind of have to have their sort of their little mantra of what they say first, right, about here's what's going to happen with what you tell me and here's what's not going to happen with it, right? We have to get them to be talking in that way first. because it's not, when they become an agent of your organization, it's just, it's not as clear cut. But a lot of communities develop groups, and so in our community we have a group called that I organize, and we started called COPE, and COPE stands for Kids Organizing for a Peaceful Environment. And the way that we got the schools to make referrals and have kids, and we had separate groups for girls and boys, is to get them to come during their school time, was that we made an agreement with the school that this would not just be a process group, meaning, you know, in terms of education about their own experience, it would also be a social justice group. And so the school was excited about that, so that's how we approached it with them. And because what ended up happening through that is that because they're not sort of working for us, they're doing this as part, you know, of their own experience, they're getting the information, but they're not necessarily acting as an agent of our organization as peer educators. And so we just spent a lot of time talking about, of course, healthy relationships and about physical violence and sexual violence and, you know, and stalking and infatuation and all these, you know, sort of topics. But we also made sure that they became, you know, presenters and in their own community, and that they did things within the community to help end all types of domestic violence. And so that was the way that we got the school to agree to allow some school time to be used. Because there's a way in which the school does their schedule where they all got, you know, their time off during the, you know, they get like this half hour during the day or an hour during the day, depending upon their schedule. And so that was really helpful for us.
Cool,
yeah,
thank you.
But those aren't easy issues, you know, when it comes to teens.
Right, thank you.
Yeah.
Amy, are there any other questions in the queue right now?
We do have one more question at this time. It comes from Domestic Violence. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Julie. I'm from the Domestic Violence Resource Center in Rhode Island. I just wanted to comment about the peer advocate group. I think it was Colorado that was doing that. We do something that I think is kind of interesting in our area. We do, it's probably part of the community education piece for later, but I figured I'd mention it now. We, in order to get the word out to teens in the schools right now, one of the rural schools, we have a play that we do, and we have about 10 of the students from the school volunteer. They come in and they work on a play that was written by two girls about a real story. You know, it was about a friend of theirs. And it's a teen dating violence play. And we go into all of the 10th grade health classes. And what I do with the students is I train them in, you know, the dating violence and the issues and so forth. They learn the play. We go in. They present the play for the classrooms. And then they answer questions. And they ask questions about the play to kind of process it. While they're doing this, they have kind of on their own decided to be advocates for us. So at the end of the play, they'll tell the students in the classroom, if you have a problem and you don't want to talk to, you know, someone, you know, one of the adults here, come and find one of us and we'll help you. And the way that we're training them to help is that we have a social service unit at the school, and I'm there one day a week. I also run a couple of support groups for girls. So what they do is they can go to the teen advocate, but then that teen advocate will bring them to us. They'll come with them. So it kind of takes away the concern about what the teen advocate is going to actually do or not do, you know, where one of the students could actually, you know, have a potential for being harmed. They will come to us and, you know, we can work with them. And I can either see them individually or, you know, we can encourage them to join one of our support groups. But it's been a really good program.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. And while you're on the phone, is it Rhode Island that?
Yes.
It is. Okay. I just want to. Well, I have you on my. I'll just ask. Do you want to just say just a quick couple of things about that, or are you
about the law?
Yeah.
Sure. We have it's the Lindsay and Burke Act. Lindsay and Burke was murdered by a boyfriend several years ago, and she was a Rhode Islander. And her mom and her dad have become very, very influential in putting this act through. And what it's stating is that from grades 7 through 12. Some form of healthy relationship, teen dating violence curriculum needs to be provided for students during their school year. And we've seen the schools starting to really pick up the ball. For example, at the school that I do the play at, the 10th grade health classes will have classroom education on healthy relationships and dating violence and so forth, and then we come in and we kind of piggyback on that with our play. So they get like three different kinds of learning of it, you know, like they like we provide the visual part. It's hoped that, you know, as the act, you know, as the time goes on, that every school will definitely have this in their curriculum. Right now, I don't know that every single school has it, but they're all working toward it. The teachers are being trained. And then our role as a domestic violence agency is to basically go in and provide support to them and help them out. We do still do a couple of the trainings in some of the schools, but the schools are definitely a lot more open, to even for us coming in to do a presentation, which is wonderful. So,
right.
And we're going to start teaching healthy relationships actually in the middle schools, because we find that the eighth graders need it as much as the high schoolers. And sometimes, you know, if we can get to the eighth graders before they get to the high school and really start dating, sometimes it's helpful.
Right. Thank you. I'm so glad that you're on the call, because I, you know, I never want to give like bad information. I just knew I read about it and online and on the paper. So
it's been great.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that information. Yeah. Our thoughts go out to her family, because I'm sure it's still so painful for them.
It is. She's a terrific woman. She's I worked with her a few times, and you know, she's great. She goes into, I mean, when she goes into a classroom, she doesn't pull any punches. She's very, very upfront about what happened, and you know, your heart just really goes out to her. But
right.
I'm really, you know, we're so grateful that she's doing it.
Great, great. Thank you for sharing.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you.
We also have a question from Haven of Hope. Your line is open.
Go ahead.
Let's just take this last call, and
okay.
Then, Melissa, if you would go back to your PowerPoint, and then we'll stop again for questions after,
sure.
You know, 25 minutes.
Sounds good.
Thanks. Go ahead, caller.
Haven of Hope, your line is open. Please be sure you're not muted on your end.
You might want to try pressing star 6 to open your line up in case you're on mute. Are you there?
Well, at least they responded, but they muted themselves. Let me unmute them. Haven of Hope, please go ahead.
We actually didn't press anything, so I'm not quite sure how that happened.
Okay, well, we're glad you're here.
Yeah, we're here, but we didn't mean to do that.
Okay,
go ahead.
We don't have any questions at this time.
Okay. All right. Maybe next time.
Okay.
All right, great. Yeah.
Thanks. Okay, so
okay.
Go ahead, Melissa, if you would.
Okay, sure, thanks.
Thanks.
So I want to talk a little bit about technology and abuse. And before I say anything about this, I want to say sometimes I feel like, well, I know we could do an entire call just on this. And this is something that we all need to be aware of. And you know, I know that the National Network to End Domestic Violence and the Safety Net Project has an extraordinary amount of resources on this topic. And so I don't know if I put them as a resource on the end. Oh, I don't think that I did on the end of the PowerPoint. But the National Network to End Domestic Violence does a lot of technical assistance and training about technology and abuse. So I just want to make sure that people know that. But of course we want to mention this because we know this is part, a large part of teens' lives, how they communicate, the ways in which they communicate. And so in terms of teen dating violence relationships, we always want to remember, of course, that one of the persons may not be a teen. And so in the relationship, and so of course, you know, we probably all have some sort of horror story of someone who was, you know, sought after online, someone who met online, and then someone who was harmed online. There's many, many very sort of tragic stories about that. But, you know, there's a lot of meeting of people online. And sometimes, of course, as I mentioned, that one of those persons is not really a teen. It's an adult, and it's someone who's seeking to perpetrate on a young girl or a young boy as part of a very violent and sexually violent relationship. But we also know that teens do meet online, and that they communicate extraordinary amount online, and that they do it through, of course, you know, the most common social network sites are MySpace, Facebook. You know, instant messaging isn't as popular, I'm told, at least in our local area. as it used to be, and then email, you know, of course, is always a way. But these social networking sites not only provide a way for teens to communicate about relationships in terms of just day-to-day communicating, but they provide a mechanism to provide a lot of emotional harm, and a lot of, course, pictures get posted online. We have lots of stories about this, and a lot of pressure that comes from. And so, you know, there's a whole series, of course, we could do about cyberbullying, but just as it, particularly as it relates to teen dating violence relationships, I think maybe it's best through an example is what, in our community, what ended up happening was there was a dating relationship in which one of the girls was physically harmed, and she had a physical bruise, and she ended up telling one a friend about it, and that friend ended up telling other people, and what ended up happening is that people ended up conversing about it online, and what through Facebook and or my, I don't know which one it was, but anyway, what they ended up doing was that they ended up talking about this girl and really just sort of degrading her. And then, of course, there's lots of examples where if a teen girl or if they seek to end the relationship, will then experience a lot of harassment and bullying online. And then some people break up with each other online and on the Internet. And so there's a whole lot of interaction and communication that happens. And I just have to share this example of something that happened yesterday. We I happen to have a mother and a 15-year-old girl come in yesterday, and the mom is in a very highly contested divorce. The father was physically and sexually violent to the mom and the girls. And so what, and the dad was communicating with the girls online, but also this girl had a boyfriend. And what ended up happening in this scenario was that the mom got some sort of software, and I know they're out there. I don't have teenagers yet, and so I haven't had to search them. But she got a software where she would get an email about everything that her daughter wrote online. And it ended up being used in court. And I have to tell you that the reason why the mom did this was because she wanted to know what was happening in her daughter's relationship because she was so scared. And the daughter had to make an appearance in court and find out about it there. And she was very, very, of course, upset with her mom. And so in a way that I was so concerned that the teenage girl talked about running away. And so we have to be careful about, you know, every parent, and I'm not going to make a judgment about whether a parent should do this or not, but we have to be very careful about the ramifications are about this and about whether we as domestic violence agencies encourage this or not, you know, with parents. And so there's a there are ways, of course, for parents to find out what their teens are doing online. But we also have to think about it in our way in which we talk with parents about, you know, what it is they want to know and are they going to be okay with what they find out, what they're going to do with it, and how it's going to affect their relationship with their teenager. So particularly when we talk about technology, we have to think about who the parent audience and the adult audience is for the teenagers. And then, of course, cell phones are, you know, there's a lot of instant communication. Most of it's happening through text messaging. Some of it, of course, is happening through phone calls. And then, of course, you know, there's a phenomenon that's happening with what's called sexting, and if you haven't heard of that term, it's about sending pictures of each other in terms of, you know, body parts and maybe in a sexual position of some sort, maybe not, and sending those pictures over text messaging. And so there's a lot of, in fact, I recently saw a commercial about this, which I was happy to see. But I will tell you, you know, that this is very, very enticing for teens. And one of my best friends has a 15-year-old, and she had not gotten her daughter had a cell phone but did not have a text messaging plan. And so for Christmas this year. That's what she gave her daughter. She said, okay, I feel like she's responsible enough. I'll give it to her. And I have to tell you that, so she's, my friend is a prosecutor, so she prosecutes domestic violence and sexual violence crimes. And so she spent a lot of time talking to her about, if I find out that you do this, if you do any of this, you know, sending any pictures of yourself. And I know this 15-year-old girl really well and consider her to be, you know, really responsible and quite mature, I thought, for her age. She's a really good kid. And so her mom spent a lot of time talking to her. And they live in a rural area, you know, like many of us do, where the cell coverage isn't the best. And so the night on Christmas night at about 2 o'clock in the morning, she heard this sort of these feet upstairs of the house. And here was her daughter in the corner of the house, the one corner of the house where she got really good reception. And she was so intense in looking at her phone and her text messages that she didn't even hear her mom walk up to her. And she said, Dakota, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Give me your phone. And so she, and of course, she didn't want to give it to her, but she did end up giving it to her. And so it was within 24 hours. And this young girl had a boyfriend. And she, within 24 hours of getting texting, had sent pictures of herself naked. And so I tell you this story because there was extraordinary pressure for her to do it, and that her mom ended up reading all of the text messages. And they were like, you know, if you really love me, you'll do this. I promise you I won't show them to other people. And so we need to, you know that even with the best information, some teenagers and young kids are still going to do it with all the information that they need. And so that's why we have to think about this monitoring so sort of closely about what that's going to look like. And so we have to be thinking about that. But we also have to be thinking about that when I find out what ends up happening in particular with text messaging is that I believe it's sort of as a form of communication because we're doing it in a typing way and we're doing it in a way in which we don't hear or feel the emotion of the other human, that we're more apt to say things or write things that are harmful, hurtful, and damaging to each other. And this is particularly true in teen relationships. And so we have to really understand this and think about this. I have to tell you, with the teens that our agency has sent orders for protection with and harassment restraining orders, that our support staff has spent an extraordinary amount of time typing up text messages. And I'm not that old, but I'm just baffled by some of the things that have been written back and forth to each other. And it's something that's happening that we have to be aware of. And pay particularly close attention to. And we also have to be thinking about when teens are breaking up and thinking about the pressure that happens from friends and families about, one, either to do the breaking up and what's happening. So we have to think about, so for example, I had a mom of a teenage girl come in and she just said, okay, I'm at my last straw. She said, I have now told her, if she doesn't break up with him, I'm not paying for anything beyond when she's 18. I don't care if she wants to go to college. I don't care if she wants to do. I'm done. That's going to be how I'm going to handle this because nothing else is working. And I just said to her, I said, I know that seems like a really rational thing to do at this point because this is how you're feeling. But what I know is that most of those sort of tactics are going to push your daughter even farther away from you and closer to him. And so that was really hard for her to hear, but this stuff, in terms of when we're talking with parents or friends, is that what I encourage friends and parents to do is to find ways to get closer to them so that they'll be open to them and disclose more to them as opposed to using ultimatums with them. Because a lot of friends and family members get fed up with it and they don't want to deal with it. Or they've washed their hands of it. And so we really have to be thinking about how we're talking with teens about breaking up. A lot of teens don't break up because we talked about infatuation already, but also just about the status in the community about having a partner and that we have to understand that within the social community of teenagers, for a lot of girls in particular, to have a boyfriend brings some status in terms of a hierarchical level. We also have to understand that, of course, an extraordinary amount of them are very scared. They're scared about the controlling behaviors, about the dangerousness of their partners. They're scared about what their partner will do to them. They're scared that they've disclosed things to their partner, that they will then tell everyone, that they'll tell their parents. And also possibly if they've done something illegal, you know, maybe if they've stolen something or done something even worse, that their partner who they're breaking up with will steal from them. As a safety measure, one of the things that we do encourage teens to do is that if we feel like it's a very dangerous situation, we encourage them to not break up with the other teen in person whenever possible, unless it's in a public place and with someone who will be there to support them. Because what we often know what will happen is that the person who's being broken up with will go to one of two extreme measures. They'll be extraordinarily empathetic and just sad and just sorry for what they've done, or they're going to be extraordinarily dangerous. And so we really encourage teens who are in very dangerous relationships to not do it in person. That oftentimes we encourage them to do it over the telephone. We talk to them about some words to use, about how to do it respectfully and about how to end it. And then to also then talk to them to know that in most teen relationships, when one person says it's done, it's ended, that it's usually, of course, not that clean of a break. I mean, we know that from our own relationships we've all had in our own lives and with adult relationships. But that teens really need a lot of support and friends from family during the breakup. And what they don't need to hear was, oh, I'm glad you finally did it, or yeah, he was such a jerk, or, you know, all those things that we have to also be talking to family and friends about during that breakup phase. And then we also have to be talking with them about saving text messages and voicemails that come from after the breakup in teen dating violence relationships, about never delete those, save them. We may need them. We need to document those. We need to record those for ourselves. And then when we're thinking about the legal issues, this, of course, is another one that we could spend an entire topic talking about. And I'm not an expert in other states' issues as it relates to confidentiality of teens. All I can tell you is what I know based on my experience here in this state. But what I can tell you is that the best resource I know about confidentiality in any domestic violence work for teens, adults, any person, is the Confidentiality Institute. And a woman named Julie Kunzfield does this work, and she's a national expert on this. And if you go to the confidentialityinstitute.org, you'll find all the resources you need. But basically, the components of what you need to know is you need to know what your state law says about the age, about when teenagers can have a confidential relationship with you and when they can't. So, for example, in the state of Minnesota, if a teenager is starting at the age of 16, you can enter into a confidential relationship with them, in which you do not have to disclose to their parents. Now, there are some there's some other language about that you should, you know, I don't think there's anyone lying from Minnesota, but within your state, you need to read it and know it. But generally, that's the way it works within our state, and so we're able to have those relationships. Now, with teens under the age of 16, if they disclose to you and you're a mandated reporter, there are parameters around that we must all follow, that we have to be aware of. One of the most tricky things that we must all think about, know, and understand, and particularly in rural communities, because we know how people inevitably find out how, you know, some service providers ended up talking to someone, is that, let's say, for example, the teen's name is Jane, and Jane's parents are divorced, and mom has joint legal custody that also has physical custody, or but has sole physical custody but joint legal custody. In some states, so for example, if I was going to talk to Jane because she's under 16, I need her mom's permission. In some states, I also need dad's permission. Now, this is problematic for many, many teens who are in dating violent relationships. One, because many fathers are very worried about what the teenager is going to tell you about them, because many of them experience the living in a home with violence themselves, and so that becomes an issue. There's a sense of and a notion of privacy that a lot of parents don't want to have their kids talking to anyone, and particularly anyone they don't know or haven't talked to themselves. And so we have to understand these issues, and it's not something that a lot of people think about, but you have to understand what it means to have legal custody within your state, and if you have to disclose to the other parent. A lot of times, one parent will give permission, another won't, and it depends on what your state law says about that. And then, of course, for restraining orders, the two major issues are you have to know what the qualifications are within your state. Now, for example, in the state of Minnesota, if you're 16 or older, you can file on your own. Or if you have a child, if you have a child with someone, even if you're under 16, I think it's 13 and older, you don't have to have a parent do the order for protection for you against the other parent of the child. There's a lot of issues that relates to restraining orders, orders for protection, harassment restraining orders, or whatever, you know, the name of them are in your state. One of the big issues I know that always comes up is about schools. So, for example, if Jane's in a relationship with John and Jane files a harassment restraining order against John and she doesn't want John to have any contact with her anymore, what does that mean in terms of the fact that they share a school? And then we know in rural communities, often, one, the physical space of the school is quite small, so chances are they're going to run into them. The class offerings aren't that vast, and so they're probably going to end up in a class with them. And so what does all that mean? I have been a part of a few harassment restraining orders where the petitioner of the order has asked the student to be removed from the school, and judges have granted those. Now, those were some really big legal fights. But we knew that in order for this teen to be real safe, and this young girl was not willing to leave her school. She didn't feel like she should. She didn't feel like she had to. And she fought it in court. And the teen abuser in this case was required to change schools. And this is actually brought to appeal in the state of Minnesota. They lost the appeal, but it is an issue that comes up about how is it that they will not have contact within a school. And so those are just a couple very, very quickly examples of the legal issues. The parents of teens?
Melissa, yep. Could I just ask a question?
Yes.
Is there, where do programs find out what their individual rules and regs are by state? Is there any kind of one concise resource for that, or...
Well, I think that, for confidentiality, as I mentioned, the Confidentiality Institute is a great place, you know, to go in terms of that. In terms of the legal rights, I always encourage people to call two places, one of which is their coalition in their state is most often going to know that. You know, they have lawyers on their staff, or the Battered Women's Justice Project out of Minneapolis has a civil office. And so, you know, I know that they're always a great resource. And then, you know, there's some teen dating violence. If you go to breakthecycle.org is a website, but some of the resources I have at the end. But, you know, these are just some of the issues we have to be thinking about.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I want to make sure that, and I've kind of talked about parents a little bit already, and so just sort of in the interest of time, I want to spend just the last bit of time talking about community education schools and then break for questions? Or Liz, do you think we should break now?
Let's just check in briefly if we can.
Okay.
There's still several slides left. So is there any questions or comments at this point based on the information we've just covered in the last half an hour or so?
And if you do have a question, please press the number 1 at this time. It looks like we have a question from Haven of Hope. Your line is open.
Yes, I was just curious about the website that you had given earlier.
Okay, which one?
The confidentiality one?
Yeah.
Well, I didn't catch that.
Oh, sorry. It's confidentialityinstitute.org.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, I should have put that on the resources, but and as I said, Julie Kunzfields is a national expert on that. In fact, I'm just going to pull it up now just to make sure that that's it. But, yeah, it's confidentialityinstitute.org,
okay.
I believe.
Right.
Yep, that's it. I just pulled it up. So.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have no further questions at this time.
All right, let's go back, Melissa. And
okay.
We'll finish your PowerPoint and then about... if we can, 5 minutes before we end, let's just check in again with programs briefly.
Sure, sure.
Thanks.
So the last slides I'm going to talk about, this is my favorite, one of my favorite topics to talk about is doing community education and outreach to teens, just because I think there's so many innovative and exciting and fun ways just to address this topic that can reach teens. And so I'm glad that a few people shared this you know, some of the things that they're doing already through peer education and through plays. And but there's a few things that I just want to mention, and one of which is I believe that any time we do a presentation to any group, we always want to assess what's the thinking in the room. Because what we know is that it's the beliefs and the thinking of people that justifies their actions. And so we want to get a sense of what's, you know, the thinking that's going on. And so here's just a few examples. So, you know, I grew up in a generation of, you know, I love the movie Grease. It's just like one of my favorite movies. And, you know, there's lots of great songs in it. And it brings out some stereotypical thinking about men and women. And so one of the things that I often do at the very beginning of a presentation with teens is I play the song Summer Lovin'. And so what I do is at the beginning of this, and I've done this from 7th grade to 12th grade, and I say, okay, I want all the boys to stand up and go to one side of the room and all the girls to stand up and go to the other side of the room. And then what I've done is I've typed out all the words to the song Summer Lovin'. And ahead of time I've asked the teacher to pick one boy, because they know them, of course, say, okay, I want you to pick one boy who I think would be good to be sort of in a mock relationship with me. And so the teacher's pre-selected who the student will be, and so I have one boy come up to the front. And so what I've done is I've just kind of, I know some website that has the lyrics to this song, and I get the whole class to sing along to the song. And so what I've done is I've typed out boy group for where the group of boys sings, girl group where the group of girls sings, and then where the single boy and the single girl sing. And the reason why I like this, one, it gets them engaged, and they think it's funny and silly. But the other thing is that what comes from this song, if you haven't ever read the words, and there are lots of songs out there, but I really think it's important to use other medium, particularly with young kids and with teens. And so, if, you know, this doesn't have to be your song. You can find another one. But one of the reasons why I like this one is because it has a lot of stereotypes in it. And so, for example, one of the phrases is the girl tells her girlfriends, yeah, we stayed out till 10 o'clock. And the boy tells his boyfriends, well, we made out under the dock, right? And so this song, I'm sure you all know, it goes and that's the sort of way it goes throughout it. And so we spend time then talking about that, about whether, you know, is that what's happening, about how much of what sharing in relationships is real, about how boys think differently about relationships than girls. Because the one thing I know when you talk about this topic with teens, I have not found it to be very effective to start talking about violence. That I start from a place of talking about relationships and about what our thinking is about it. And so that we sort of start there. And so, and then, you know, throughout the time, I've also done things like put up statements on a board, so, you know, ones that will just get a reaction on them, and then use those statements or belief statements to draw out their own thinking. So I've put up, for example, like, girls should be treated like queens by their boyfriends. I've just written that up there, and then I just have them all respond to that, and that generates a lot of conversation. I've also put on or handed out the article, I'm sure many of you have seen it, including the PowerPoint, the Good Housekeeping article from 1955, The Good Wife's Guide. And it also allows teens to think about relationships historically, about relationships. So if you haven't seen that, I'm not going to go through it now, but there's a lot of good, let's call it material, to be used to develop a relation or a conversation about relationships. And then I've done one that I know a lot of teens like, and also young middle schoolers like, is I've gone through a series of questions, and I've asked them to just to basically pick a side. And so what I've done is I go through a relationship. So I say, okay, how many of you think that only boys or young men, you know, depending on my age group, I'll just say boys right now, how many of you think that only boys should ask girls out on a date? If you think that only boys should ask a girl on a date, then I want you to stand up. If you think that it's perfectly acceptable for a girl to ask a boy on a date, I want you to stay sitting down. And so, you know, that's how we kind of start. And if it's a really large group, for example, I did it with three classes of middle schoolers in a gym, I had them pick a side of the gym. And then I would go through it, and the progression that I do is that what I'm eventually getting to is I'm getting to questions of that really hone in on controlling aspects of a relationship. So, for example, I've gone through a series of questions about, you know, about how young boys are socialized and how young girls are socialized, and some of them I've done, for example, they've said, okay, I've asked the boy, I'd say, okay, I want you to give me the most manly, macho walk you can do. And I want you to do it from this side of the room to the other side. And then I ask the girls to do the same thing. And so I'm first starting talking about them, and then I'm starting asking questions like, okay, I want you So I'll go eventually to an adult relationship and thinking about longer term, but I ask them questions about if you think that, you know, that when it, in adult relationships, that it's only men should ask women to marry, right? And so I'm asking them what they think about that. And then I'm going to move to, I want you to imagine that you and, you know, your partner now are now much older in your life, and I want you to be thinking about, you know, for example, that let's just say that the wife doesn't work and she stays at home, and that the husband works, and the husband's kind of always had this dream car that he wanted to buy, and it's a Friday, and they both decided that they're going to buy this car, and they got it, and but that Friday night happens to be the Friday night that the mom's, the wife is going to be going out with her friends for that night. And how many of you think that the mom should be able to take out the new car? And how many of you think that she should have to take the minivan? You know, that she shouldn't be able to take out the new car on the first trip, that she needs to take the other car. And so is this really... It's really little instances like that, and you can make these up and make up your own examples, but use this slow progression to get to really some very controlling aspects of relationships. And so that I'm going to draw out. And so remember, what I'm always trying to do is I'm trying to draw out the beliefs and the thinking. And I have to tell you that, you know, the car example might be just a silly one to use, but I'll tell you, every time I do that one, and I'm sure you can all imagine this, but the number of young boys who believe that men are entitled to the money in relationships and are entitled to access to things that cost money is very, very high. And so it's little examples like that will draw out some of that thinking. I also go through asking them to think about, you know, what are you looking for in a relationship? What's an ideal partner, you know, when I'm talking to some of the older groups? You have to be really sensitive and aware that you're going to probably hear some real sexist remarks or homophobic remarks. But then you ask them to make lists, and you have them compare that. But once again, I'm gonna do it in a way in which I'm asking, drawing out their thinking and sharing some of my own, as opposed to just speaking it myself. You also want to draw out, and you want to make sure when you're talking with teens and young teens about jealousy, you want to talk about this topic in a way. And so there's a lot of ways that you can do that. We've done I know someone mentioned doing the play. Our play is also this is this dating role play that we do, and ours is this school lunch example, and it's a role play that brings out jealousy that ends in violence, but we really spend a lot of time talking about jealousy and about controlling behaviors. I also do an example. It's called the sandbag example. So I tell all of them, I want you to imagine that all of you are in this room and I'm in control of this room. And at any point, I have a clicker in my hand, and if I press the number corresponding with your seat, a sandbag will fall on your head and either severely injure you or maybe even kill you. And I want you to tell me how you're going to act towards me in this relationship. And I'm going to tell them that they don't have any access to resources and they don't have a way to get out. And the reason why I'm doing this is that what often happens, particularly with amongst teens, is that there's a lot of victim blaming that's happening. And so we want to also draw out some thinking and compassion and empathy about what it's like to be the victim in one of those relationships. And so when we do this example, we're able to draw, you know, the number of them that would just be very nice to me because they're scared, the number of them who may try and use some violence back, and giving some context to that. And so we've used that example also. We've also talked about objectification, and it's not a word that I would use with them, that's the word I'm using with you, but we've done a lot of things where we've talked about how our bodies get used for as sexual objects and how it affects our thinking. And so we've had them do this, and we have our own too, but we have them just take any magazine that their family might have in their house and have them clip out any of the advertisements or the artwork that portrays women or boys in a sexual way for advertising, because then we talk with them about how that affects their own thinking and their own relationships, and we talk with them about that imagery. And then we also talk with them about relationships in terms of how we think relationships should be organized. So a lot of teens carry with them some of their own thinking that they got from their parents about that someone has to be in control of a relationship. And so we spend some time talking with them about that. We talk with them about what it means to have a healthy relationship in terms of equal regard for each other. And then the thing I always encourage is to do a focus group with youth and talk with them informally or formally about these issues to draw out more exercises and ways. And then there's a lot of movie clips, teen movies. There's ones that you can buy as resources for domestic violence organizations to have at your access that of, you know, young girls who've told stories. We've brought a play to our community called The Yellow Dress, and you can find out about them. They're just, you know, one of many, but it's a story about a young girl who ends up being murdered as part of a teen dating violence relationship. So we've brought that to our community, and we've had that done before the entire school audience. You also have to remember that we need to be talking about with them about their experience with their parents. We know that teens' thinking and beliefs come from often their own experience and influence with their own parents. And so talking with them about what they've learned about relationships from their parents, about what's normal for them. I've also just told a lot of, you know, short stories about battered women that were in very, very violent relationships. And, you know, I don't talk about the gruesome aspects all the time about it, but just some of the real controlling behaviors that, you know, that they can relate to. But we have to be talking with them about, you know, what their models are and what their experiences are with the adults in their own lives and what sort of influence that has had on their life. And then one of the last things that I always end with is I always end with a slideshow with music. And the reason why I end with that is because I'm not a person that, when I do presentations, that spends a lot of time just sort of throwing out statistics in sort of verbally, but I like to do it in an interactive way. So we've developed a slideshow that's set to music, and the song is called How Come How Long. This is a song written by Babyface, and it's a story about being in a violent relationship. And so while the song is playing, we have this PowerPoint slideshow that comes up of imagery and with statistics about violent relationships that we use. And it's been really powerful, and it's always a good way, I think, to end the presentation. And we use this for almost all of our community education presentations. And then, of course, the resources, as I mentioned, Jackson Katz has a whole bunch of things. I hope you're familiar with him. If you aren't, I really encourage you to. He has a video series, a book series about tough guys, about how we socialize young boys to be violent. The Yellow Dress I mentioned. The websites, See It and Stop It, Love is Respect, Break the Cycle, Praxis International. There's a whole bunch of good internet resources for you. So I've talked a whole too much, and so I'm going to stop right there and open it up.
So in the last few minutes that we have available today, we'd love to hear your thoughts and questions and comments. So if you would press 1 on your telephone, you'll get into the operator queue, and we'll be able to have your line individually unmuted.
You have a few people lining up. First, we'll hear from McLean Resource Center. Your line is open.
Hi, I am calling from North Dakota, and I am in particular concerned about the technology abuse, and I am wondering if you know of any trainings that are out there that is going to be available in the next, you know, in 2010 to kind of address this.
Yep. Go to the National Network to End Domestic Violence's website, SafetyNet. They have what's called the SafetyNet Project. And so I think it's just nnedv.org. And they do all the training and technical assistance that I'm aware of on technology and abuse in all relationships.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We did have someone else in the queue, but they just stepped out. If you do have a question or a comment at this time, please press the number 1.
There are no other questions at this
time. We do have one more. This will be St. Francis County Domestic Violence Program. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Cassandra calling from Arkansas.
Hi.
And we just did a presentation in the schools leading up to February for Teen Dating and Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we spoke to girls. It was in a girls' health class. And I came in late, I apologize, but I was getting half of the information about the resources for young men. I heard you say Jackson Katz, is that geared towards young men or?
Yeah, Jackson Katz has a series, a DVD series and a, excuse me, book series. Also the Domestic Abuse Project in Minnesota, so their website is mndap.org. They've developed a curriculum for working with young men around
the MMDAP?
Yep. So it's Minnesota Domestic Abuse Project. I would check their website. They have resources particularly geared for just teen groups that are very, very useful and helpful.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that. I've really been looking for something for young men.
Sure, yep.
At this time, there are no further questions in the queue.
All right. Melissa, do you have any things to send us off with, any closing comments?
Oh, no, just that I think that, you know, I always think it's important for when it comes to teens and dating just to share, you know, some of the creative things that people are doing. So I'm always interested in those. And you can either email Liz or email me those. And I'd love to just to compile sort of some of the innovative things that and creative things that people are doing around this topic. And Liz, actually just thinking about, you know, the question about technology and abuse, I think that, you know, at some point we should probably ask someone from the Safety Net Project to do a audio conference training related
yeah.
to this topic, because they'd be, you know, they're very, very well versed in it.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, very good. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. Thanks so much, Melissa. You always have so much good information for us and do such a good job on these trainings. I really, really appreciate it. So just a quick little reminder that we would love it and really appreciate it if you would take just a couple of minutes to quickly fill out our online evaluation from the call today to give us your thoughts so we can incorporate your experiences and your feedback into our future programming. So don't forget to do that. The link to the survey was in the email reminder for this session today. I should also just let you all know that Melissa, as a technical assistance provider with Praxis, is available to your programs as rural grantees to help you work with you individually to think through circumstances in your community and perhaps strategize community awareness, community education campaigns, or think through whatever the issue is that is relevant to you. So don't hesitate to contact either Melissa as follow-up to this training today, and her contact information was in the last slide of the PowerPoint, or myself, liz@praxisinternational.org, and we will be happy to get you coordinated in that way so that you will have benefits through your OVW resources. Thank you, everybody. Stay warm, stay healthy, and we'll talk with you again. Thanks so much, Melissa.
Thank you.